There we go. Okay, do you think this, yeah, it looks like it's responding. All right, so we will try to fulfill our duties and produce a file and so forth. Now, thinking about where we had left off last time, we were in the midst of perhaps the most important portion of the entire giant novel. Certainly one of the most crucial, as early as it comes in the novel. And you'll remember the scene as it was set, with the dialogue between Ivan and Alyosha, two young men, and I just suggested behind them stand two old men, two father figures of very, very different kinds. One being Zosima and his kindly presence, his philosophy of active love, and one being the Grand Inquisitor. A man who, I think Ivan gives us the overall impression that a man who has struggled with his faith, struggled with the meaning of his faith, and come up with a grand solution. The two represent, I think, for Dostoevsky, kind of stark opposition. Both of them propose their way as helps to the human race. One is fictitious, one real, and they concentrate in a positive and negative way, I think, the outcome of Dostoevsky's prophetic vision. Now, I just mentioned that some texts get easily misread in the history of literature. This is one of the greatest examples. It's one that has been lifted out of its context, included in philosophical anthologies, treated as if it were philosophy or philosophy of religion or philosophy of politics, or as if it were a definitive statement of what Dostoevsky believed. All of these things are false. It helps to have a term like dialogical to, but we really don't need that fancy a term. It's merely, it should not be taken out of context. Right? We talked a bit last time about a story within a story having an especially intense significance in this novel, that what we get to understand through this story especially is Ivan's mind and Ivan's own struggle. So we see a false dilemma, that is, in other words. And it's one that gives us a gentle but impotent Jesus, right, who is has come face to face with a wise old dictator who's placed in the 16th century, but who is, in a sense, much more a kind of prophetic figure of the future from Dostoevsky's point of view. One who has decided that for the best welfare of human beings, he must take away their freedom. And remember, of course, that in the face of the Inquisitor's logical argument and his power, this Christ ends by simply silently going up to him and kissing his cheek. Again, I pointed out that the era of an egregious misreading of this work may be over, it may be lessening. We have found that Romano Guardini, a great modern theologian, had written an essay denouncing the Grand Inquisitor, or exposing, I should say, the Grand Inquisitor as not Dostoevsky's Christ, at least. This came out a long time ago I want to say the Partisan Review, but I'm not even sure what review it was in. I think I have a Xerox of it somewhere. But at any rate, I think the most active speaker against the argument that this was Dostoevsky's Christ was Louise Cowan. And so I want to, if not do justice to this interpretation, at least bring it before you as much as I can. Now, we have to remember that this was written in 1880. Okay? So well before that century of totalitarianism that the 20th century turned out to be. And we do have to remember that the totalitarianism did not exist on merely one side, but on both sides of great oppositions in ways that made them, although there were terrible and bloody oppositions, very much the same in many uncanny ways. So we see then the connection between the story and Yvonne's earlier article, in which he said that the state should become the church. For in dictatorships that came to be in the 20th century, the state took on that character of an all-engrossing, an all-encompassing religion, all-encompassing way of life. And we think of Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, and in fact, many others. Of those, certainly the most infamous of them. No one had seen this possibility before Dostoevsky. The model for politics in the 19th century was a diplomatic one, right? War is diplomacy by other means. So, who said that? I've forgotten. Somebody will know this. In there. War is simply politics by other means, or diplomacy by other means. Famous statement from a 19th century political thinker. All right, moving right along. And thankfully, I'm not being tested for this. Anyway, my point in the 19th century was viewed politics as a rational procedure, right? And the model for much of the 19th century was the ending of the Napoleonic War and the grand peace that came out of 1815 treaty. Thank you so much, Rex. All right, I'm going to go ahead and start this sign-up sheet around and ask each of you to sign up. And then down below, I've got a notation that if you can't make any of these times, please write your name and write a time for when you might do it. My Tuesdays and Thursdays are pretty taken up, so Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is best for me. Okay. All right, so I'm making this general comparison. In general, just asking you to think how uncanny it is that someone in 1880 is seeing this. It also, however, admitting that it's uncanny that, you know, only 30-some-odd years after this, what nobody had foreseen would, in fact, come to pass. Why had no one foreseen it? Why had only the most prophetic, the most poetic, the most intellectual people seen it? This terrible surprise that 1914 brought. The state is moving to take on all the roles that the church has played in times past. And part of this, of course, would have to do with communications media, right? The emergence then of the possibility of thought control, right? Of the policing of one's thoughts through propaganda, through broadcast, and through the ability to give massive commands through radio communication as well. All of those produced results that whose need had already been perhaps foreseen by one who had examined the consequences of the Enlightenment in depth. Anyway, as for Yvonne, again, we have to get to know Yvonne better. Alyosha has had a hard time up to this point getting to know his own brother. Remember the circumstances being that each of these brothers raised apart from each other and in a sense meet each other perhaps for the first time, come to know each other for the first time in this meeting where they're brought together in part to struggle over the legacy of old Fyodor. But Yvonne says that it's best to get to know someone just before leaving. He talks about this to Alyosha, and he's warm and affectionate to his baby brother, but he does say that it's best to get to know someone just before leaving. And that's very revealing about Yvonne, because that, of course, means there's no consequences, right? You can lay yourself all on the line, and you won't have to suffer, won't have to get involved in any entanglements for that. Yes?
Just approximately where is that in the chapter?
That's right near the beginning of their conversation. I don't know the
so
exact
So it's in the previous chapter, Rebellion.
It's before the Grand Inquisitor chapter, yes. So this is when also, when Yvonne says that he's going to drain the cup until he's 30, and then... Who knows, right? So again, a prophetic remark. Don't trust anyone over 30. Don't trust yourself over 30. So, and then there's an important part in which he says, I love the, tells about the statement about what he loves. You recall this? And I want to say, page 211, but that may be my... I think it, try page 211 and let's see if that's right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good. Okay, so if you've got the Norton edition, the recent Norton edition of the Brothers, that would be the bottom third of the page. All of this early part of the conversation.
What chapter is it?
Coming down. It's chapter 3 of part... Whoa. Part 1, book, I want to say book 3, am I right?
Book 4.
Thank you. Okay, book 5. It moves along, doesn't it? So anyway, you see where he's saying down at the bottom there, though I may not believe in the order of the universe, yet I love the sticky little leaves as they open in spring. I love the blue sky. I love some people whom one loves, you know, sometimes without knowing why. I love some great deeds done by men, though I've long ceased perhaps to have faith in them. Yet from old habit, one's heart prizes them. Right? So that's quite a declaration. It is really, pretty exclusive list. And it's also, in a sense, a kind of canon of Romanticism. What a romantic poet might want to write about. These are a few of my favorite things. A song that I just heard recently on the radio. And that is, you know, love is something that for Yvonne has to spring effortlessly from your breast. And he is a romantic then. Right? But we have to contrast that with Father Zosima. I love a man even in his sin. Have no fear of sin. Love everything, and love everyone. And it's an effort, it's a science even. Right? So an extreme contrast for this idea. For him, for Yvonne, I think apparently love is only love when it is spontaneous, that marks its genuineness. And that is a romantic conviction. It comes from Rousseau and from the Germans. So Yvonne thinks he's a great lover of mankind. And we might say, but without the self-irony, that the self-condemnation that Madame Polakov has given, that I love mankind, it's people I can't stand. And he is then, for that reason, however, he's an enemy of God in his own mind. He is not aware that his love is preferential. And though he's far more intellectual than Madame Polakov, he's not aware of this dimension in himself. Father Zosima makes that distinction between love in action and love in dreams, and this is his dream. And as he goes on to say, you read on 216, that I advise you never to think about it either, my dear Alyosha, especially about God, whether he exists or not. Right? And so I accept God, and I'm glad to. And what's more, I accept his wisdom, his purpose, are utterly beyond our ken. I believe in the underlying order and the meaning of life. I believe in the eternal harmony in which they say we shall one day be blended, and so forth and so on and so forth and so on. And yet, would you believe it, in the final result, I don't accept this world of God's. And although I know it exists, I don't accept it at all. It's not that I don't accept God, you must understand. It's the world created by him. Right? So it is... It's the world created by him I don't and cannot accept. But this is a classic question. I am taking a critical approach here, but let's not belittle the massive nature of this question. It's, you know, an aspect of what's called theodicy. Can God be justified? Can God's world be justified? Can suffering be justified? How is it possible? And he says, and he's quite ironic about it in a sense, although he's also being quite sincere for himself. I believe like a child that suffering will be healed and made up for, that all the humiliating absurdity of human contradictions will vanish like a pitiful mirage, and so forth, that in the world's finale, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts, for the comforting of all resentments, for the atonement of all the crimes of humanity, of all the blood they've shed. But though that all that may come to pass, I don't accept it. I won't accept it. Even if parallel lines do meet and I see it myself, I shall see it and say that they've met, but I still won't accept it.
What page is that?
So do we understand this at all? This is 216 and 217 in the Norton, and it is chapter 3. Okay. Do we understand what he's saying? He is not saying, then, that I don't believe this.
Right.
He's not making the rationalists, drawing the rationalist line in the sand. He's saying that this very world that God has created is deeply, deeply unjust. To say that there will be an eternal harmony, and he uses that phrase several times, eternal harmony. I don't recall this as a term that actually shows up in any Christian document, by the way, does it? It does, however, show up in Hegel and Schiller. And more advanced thought of the Romantics. And if eternal, so we might sum him up by saying, if eternal harmony is to be bought at the expense of the blood of an innocent child, I don't want it. Right. And so he comes to his classic formulation: I believe in this eternal order, but I most graciously return the ticket. I return the ticket. I don't want to be part of it. So that is his problem. And this, of course, leads Alyosha to say simply, well, then, therefore, you don't really believe in God. No, so, but that's not anything that he's able to pursue or that Ivan cares about at the moment. He does say, however, best response that Alyosha can give is to say, but there is someone who has taken on all those terrible sufferings, all the wrongs that everyone has done, and taken it on with and paid for it with his own blood. So he gives the answer of the center of Christianity. And of course, Ivan has a ready answer to that, and that, of course, is the lead-in to the story. I'm rushing a bit. Before he does all that, he has these tales of horrible misdeeds. We talked about this a bit last time. Dr. Dupree was bringing out a very interesting dimension that all of these seem, as we were saying, kind of prefabricated, and in fact may indicate something about the effect already of newspapers, journalism, on perception in our modern world. Not that these terrible events don't happen. Human nature is capable of atrocities, but there's a high, what do you call, a high definition character to these moments of horror that Ivan tells about, that lifts them out of their context, that we might not, so that the context becomes unimportant, robs us of the ability to judge how an event can arise out of circumstances, how it might be foreseen and forestalled in the future, what might allow us to say, and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that really essentially a huge problem for him? Because In the Grand Inquisitor, his whole point is you gave us free will, and that means that we're responsible ultimately for all of this and stuff. Isn't that?
That's the big problem.
So taking events out of context really wouldn't even be an issue for him, because just because we're capable of stopping it doesn't mean that, you know, because free will is essentially what he's taking up an issue with.
Well, I think you're right.
And all of the whole Grand Inquisitor tale is implicit in this dialogue right beforehand. Right? So it is really a very well worked out prelude to it all. So yeah, I think that's a good point. So the list, the scrapbook, right, of Ivan, and it makes him. He has compiled it. He's compiled it like a case against existence, and it makes him bitter. It makes him bitterer all the more that he does this. So, and he thinks, much like 20th century intellectuals, that his moral sense is higher than religion, is higher than any god who would allow children to suffer so. All of these, of course, are ideas only of suffering, and we have to contrast him to, as you were pointing out in previous class, Alyosha, who has already seen an angry little child and has it's led him to go and inquire about why this is so. So, Ivan builds his case against God. You know, it's at its most intense in 206. If you look at page 206, if I have the page right, do I have the page right? That doesn't sound right, does it? It's not the right page. I'm sorry, but there's a point at which he says, "Imagine that you are creating a beautiful order, an order of eternal harmony yourself." And all it demands is that you torture one tiny creature, and that whole grand edifice be built on the unavenged tears of this innocent child. Do you remember where that is? And he asks Alyosha, would you consent to that? Would you consent to this divine order if it's built on the edifice, you know, built on the structure of the unavenged tears of an innocent?
Is it on chapter 4?
Yeah, it is. Before the... It's chapter 4. Mm-hmm. But it's where... It's the moment in which... It's. I'm sorry, it's page 226 also. I don't know why I get lost on this. Would you? Rebellion, I'm sorry you call it that, said Ivan earnestly. One can hardly live in rebellion, and I want to live. Imagine that you're creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last, but that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that little child beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Tell me. And he says, no, I wouldn't consent, said Alyosha, softly. So, now the premise here is that creation is founded on intentional innocent suffering. So, again, we're plunged into another extremely deep difficulty, and this is about, omniscience and predestination and free will. The question is that, again, of free will. The Christian knows that the world is fallen and was not intended this way, and that suffering somehow is a mystery that cannot be entirely understood. None of these answers would content Ivan, however. It's at this point that Alyosha says, brother, you said just now, is there a being in the whole world who would have the right to forgive and could forgive, but there is a being, and he can forgive everything, all and for all, because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything. You have forgotten him, and on him is built the edifice. And it is to him they cry aloud, thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. And Ivan Vaughn says, ah, the one without sin and his blood. No, I've not forgotten him. And of course, this leads into his poem. The one without sin. There's a certain note of sublimity that is attached to the image of Christ with everything that Yvonne says. And this is part of it. Now, the tale itself is set in the Inquisition in 16th century Spain. And after some prelude, it has... Christ entering the city of Seville, in the bottom of 229. He came softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him, right, with a gentle smile and an infinite compassion. And he performs miracles. The crowd weeps and kisses the earth under his feet. Children throw flowers before him. It is he. Right. He stops at the steps of the Seville Cathedral at the moment when the weeping mourners are bringing in a little open white coffin. In it lies a child of 7, the only daughter of a prominent citizen. The dead child lies hidden in flowers. He will raise your child, the crowd shouts to the weeping mother. The priest, coming to meet the coffin, looks perplexed and frowns. But the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet with a wail. If it is thou... raise my child, she cries, holding out her hands to him. The procession halts. The coffin is laid on the steps at his feet. He looks with compassion, and his lips once more softly pronounce, maiden arise, and the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in the coffin and looks round, smiling with wide open, wondering eyes, holding a bunch of white roses they had put in her hand. And I think, you know, what Louise Cowan used to say, the white roses are the real tip-off there. If you haven't noticed at that point, it should be, you know, a very clear tip-off that this is a romanticized picture and not something that belongs in the kind of narrative that one sees in the New Testament. And the crowd, the presence of the crowd in this, already the pressure of the crowd. Christ in this story does his miracles in front of everyone and gets this, you know, rising approbation by the crowd. If we look back at the actual narrative, where the line maiden arise, or however it may be translated, comes from, it's from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 8, when Christ raises a child from the dead. He warned her parents to let no one know what had befallen, right? He was very concerned not to let this sort of crowd... Madness of crowds get out of control, to make it become a matter of publicity. And there's just a few subtle things. A woman throws herself at his feet. If it is thou, raise my child. Human beings are portrayed not as those able to endure suffering, but as victims who have demands. And so Yvonne exists already within that world. And we think of the image of Christ and its change throughout history. There's been a great deal of scholarship done on this. And more lately, once the influence of kind of criticism of discourse has come on in our time. Yaroslav Pelikan has a very readable book about the history of the image of Christ. There are other books that historicize it, and I think it's a topic that is worth historical study because we think of the image of Christ as unchanging as the God that he stands for, but in fact, the image of Christ is a human production and has changed subtly and dramatically over time. I think especially in the 19th century, this is something then that Dostoevsky is reacting to that happened recently in his own time. One of the key works would be by Renan, Ernest Renan, The Vie de Jésus, which was published in 1863 and was a true sensation. It was the first entirely human portrait. I mean, that is to say, the first study of Christ that assumed from the beginning that he was only and entirely human, that he was tender-hearted and pitying, and these were the great characteristics of this spiritual leader. 60,000 copies were sold in 6 months, and 23 editions is what is how many editions the book went through in the first 20 years of its existence. So an enormously influential study, one that shows, and the history of its publication shows, this was something that the readership of Europe was ready for. It was enormously influential. So Ivan shows this influence himself. It is a Europeanized mind. And 30 years before Renan, we have David Strauss, German scholar of the higher criticism of the Bible, who was one who transformed Hegelianism into a rival of Christian orthodoxy, was one of the, it was called the Young Hegelians. We recognize some of this, a goodly part of the notion of turning the state into the church comes from a certain interpretation of Hegel. Don't want necessarily to go into all the twists and turns of this. I tend to want to defend Hegel himself from the crude interpretations that had come out of some of his descendants. But that's just neither here nor there for a Dostoevsky class. Christ of the Gospels was taken to be a myth, right? And Jesus was portrayed through these influences in a wholly naturalistic way. And then we should look also, if we look back a little further, at Rousseau, right? Not for a portrait of Christ, but for what he did with Christianity in his Social Contract and elsewhere. He took the stand that Christianity preaches only servitude. And I think this is a great influence, certainly, on Ivan's tale, that the spirit of Christianity is favorable to tyranny. From this, of course, we can see also some of Nietzsche's views beginning to hatch as well. And that, as he claimed, that Christianity always profits from a tyrannical regime. True Christians are made to be slaves, and they know it. So, from Rousseau through Hegel, a bank shot that became a very popular one, state and society without religion are an impossibility, you see. So, Christianity may enslave people, may tyrannize people, may open us up to tyranny, maybe for the weak, but we can't do without religion in some way. And it was just simply, whereas nowadays, of course, it's perhaps more fashionable to truly challenge religion and say, where is it needed at all? At least, but, we have to ask, was this a good thing to say, we still need a religion, but Christianity, not so much. State and society without religion are an impossibility. That is to say, the rule of law, right? The morality needed to run an orderly state and to have a civil society. But for Rousseau, that religion cannot be Christianity. The gospel is counter to state interests. And he was not fond of what he called pagan Christianity, which perhaps you can guess what that was. No? Catholicism! Pagan Christianity, come on. Which was subversive of the state. So Christianity must be replaced. and replaced with a state religion, a civil religion. The rulers of the state should fix all the articles of faith and so forth. Yes, John.
Doesn't he also think socialism is sort of a pagan form of Christianity too? Could you see that also?
I'm not sure whether I want to go on record as saying yes, but it sounds good.
Okay.
It sounds good. I know that Rousseau was a defender of republics, of vigorous republics, you know. So there are a good part of his political thought that's quite redeemable and quite interesting. But I'm looking at this not so much as let's find figures to condemn, as let's see symptoms of how these frames of mind arose in Europe. And remember that then whatever arose in Europe became, broke loose in Russia. It's often been stated that many radical ideas were hatched in Europe, but there were so many buffers in European society that kept them from immediately going to their consequences. But in Russia, these buffers were much more out of the way. And so the dreams of radical reformation could be moved on much more quickly. Yeah.
I guess just kind of referring more back to the devils or whatever, because he doesn't seem to see there is sort of a social justice Christian aspect to socialism, but he doesn't seem to see that at all. I mean, judging from the way he critiques socialism and the devils, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was curious as to why he doesn't see the sort of Christian brotherly aspect to it, and he only sees the progressive, destructive anarchist.
Good questions. All important. By he, you mean Dostoevsky?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, just check.
I know it's hard.
No, but that's right. And in general, we're used to associating social justice and Christianity and a more socialized approach to the state. So Dostoevsky, is he simply being a cranky right-winger by saying that this should not be the case? That's, a difficult question to answer quickly and easily. But I think what makes one hesitate to say, well, yes, he must have been that way, is the care that he takes to deal constantly with the suffering of, all kinds of people in the brothers. Certainly the question of, this is the very question treated in the Grand Inquisitor story, right? Because if the state takes care of everyone, then it's not the responsibility of anyone. Right? Then no one has to care for it. They just become cared for. So there's an elision of the moral being in itself, him or herself, that becomes a much, much larger problem. I mean, that's a short answer to that question. So Dostoevsky, remember when he was in Siberia, read all of Hegel, and believe me, it's hard to do. But he had a lot of time on his hands, and he asked his brother to mail him, volumes of Hegel, and he read him. I'm sure it was in the original, so he got to know one of the better brands of modern thought in his own time. So the in a sense, Ivan is condensing many leading currents of thought in the 19th century, and the theories of the state converge on an idea that we need someone like the Grand Inquisitor to take care of us. And as Dostoevsky goes on to say, as Ivan goes on to say, and give us the freedom to sin. That allows a much greater latitude for the power of the state, and will promise a future life of happiness. So, anyway, all of this requires a great deal of thought. There have been some fine articles written on the logic of Ivan's argument. And but I want to go on through the story. Grand Inquisitor comes, has the stranger imprisoned, right? And we note Alyosha, and this is on page 231, as he says, "Is it thou? Thou?" But receiving no answer, he adds at once, "Don't answer. Be silent. What canst thou say? Indeed, I know too well what thou wouldst say. And thou hast no right to add anything to what thou hadst said of old. So why then art thou come to hinder us?" In other words, we, the church, has taken your place, and you know the logic for that is clear enough. You delegated this authority to us, so we've done it. We don't need you anymore. And Alyosha's response is very interesting. "I don't quite understand, Ivan. What does it mean?" He says, "Is it simply a wild fantasy or a mistake on the part of the old man? Some impossible qui pro quo?" So, needless to say, Alyosha at this point doesn't get it. He's looking at the characters and seeing that they don't, that they're impossible characters. And so the story is not making sense to from his own point of view. So all of these great achievements of the Grand Inquisitor has granted happiness, it says, he claims, to the people, and all it asks is their freedom. Dostoevsky's prophecy, here really entirely from seeing inherent principles in his own time. This is a prophecy of intellect and not of mysticism. And we have to remember that Russians have long been used to various forms of tyranny. So this is not so hard, perhaps, for someone in the Russian tradition to imagine. But with this crucial new dimension of the invasion of the minds of their subjects. Now, the structure of the tale really revolves on those three temptations. So from that, we are moved to a gradual recognition that the alignment of the Inquisitor is with Satan, right, with the three temptations. And those are indeed crucial issues. And perhaps it's quite possible that the reader, me for instance, has never realized just how crucial those three temptations are. And in other words, it's a pretty good exegesis of the Bible, of that Bible passage itself. Now, the first temptation of turning stones into bread, it says, you know, if we do this, if we give them bread, they will lay their freedom at your feet. He claims bread and freedom are incompatible. And in the second temptation, this is the one in which he says, go ahead, go to the top of the tower and cast yourself down, and angels will bear you up. So, my goodness, somebody's persistent, aren't they?
I'm so sorry. This is ridiculous.
There is an off button, Angel.
No, I'm sorry. My phone doesn't want you to talk about it.
I know, obviously. I've been
I'm
reported,
really
I think, already.
But it meant, I don't know, I'll have to throw it in the holy water.
And the three temptations, I think, also correspond to that formulation of miracle, mystery, and authority. And we come to realize about this time that Ivan is on the side of the Grand Inquisitor. It has not been clear up to this point. And the Inquisitor now has openly said it is Satan that he is working with. Well, now we have to recall that it's a fairly traditional formulation. Satan is the prince of this world. He's in charge of this world. It goes counter to the work of grace. And to a certain extent, you know, then that means as someone in charge of this world is more interested in perverting the lines of grace than in open war. And we've seen some of those dimensions in Milton's discussions in the Paradise Lost. Did you have a
question? So then does the Grand Inquisitor represent for Ivan more what the church should be rather than what it presently is?
Yeah. This is why he calls his poem a made-up poem. This is not meant to be a historical document, certainly not about the 16th century, not so much even about the 19th century, but about where he sees things ought to be.
So it's not more that he's saying the church presently is aligned with Satan, but more that it should take almost Satan's view in the temptations.
Yeah. And I would say, to add one more dimension to this, that this is his poem, that this is more like a mental experiment for Ivan, but it's one that he cherishes, obviously, because he has, in a sense, memorized it and retells the story over and over whenever he gets a chance. So, but it's an experience, it's on the level of an experiment. So that, in a sense, he knows that this is it's kind of a hideous outcome, but it's also one that logic leads him to. Yeah, so you can see, right, and that makes it a very suitable carrier of this whole motif. Just as Mishkin, you might remember in The Idiot, overstates the case against the Roman Church, and yet it's, although it comes out of Dostoevsky's pen, it comes filtered through the persona of Mishkin. I think it's say something of the same thing here. Right. Yeah,
how does this not work with ultramontanism, which Ivan says his views aren't?
I don't know. What is ultramontanism exactly? I know it means beyond the mountains.
They always like to characterize Roman Catholicism as Montanist. Like it's just the Roman Empire, like a new spin, basically. Where the state becomes the church instead of the church becoming the state.
Yeah.
But this seems almost to be some sort of complication of that.
Mm-hmm. It does. It does indeed. Yeah, so whenever you have the church and the state growing too close together, and it has happened many a time, right, that you have a real problem. Okay. Yes,
I was just wondering, like, what you make of Father Joseph, this comes a bit later, but his response to these, because he does, he's obviously not, like, explicitly responding to Ivan, but he talks about the Bible as being miracle and mystery and authority.
Right.
I mean, how that, like, affects our understanding of what's going on in the Grand Inquisitor.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that the points of miracle, mystery, and authority are the...
I mean, for him, they're found in the scripture.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's not seeing that as something that Christ rejected as a way of appealing to...
Isn't, I mean, if we summarize what he's doing with this, isn't he saying, Christ, you know, you should have gone with Satan on all of these three things. That would have been smarter.
Right.
And so we know that real power can't last unless it's based on miracle, mystery, and authority. And this is part of the argument given in by Rousseau and others that a state needs a religion in order to have the morale to continue to exist as a state. Right. We need something more stimulating to lead us to deal morally with each other. Otherwise, we would be the war of all against all, and so forth. Right? So, miracle, mystery, authority. This is a formulation of the three major principles of what leads us beyond just our own, well, just our own self-interest. Right? Why is this not something appended to as a capstone upon self-interest?
Right, I just thought it was interesting that that's not just the case in the Brand Inquisitor's way of thinking. It's also the case for Father Joseph, because I was kind of looking at that negatively at first.
Oh, yeah. Now, there's already a discussion, isn't there, by the narrator about miracles, right? That he says miracles do not cause faith, but faith causes miracles. That a miracle is something that comes out of faith, and that even one without faith sees it, he won't accept it even then. So there's already a, these things are motifs that we can almost match them as having a different meaning in the world of Zosima than they do in the Inquisitor's world. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just think it was interesting that he frames his idea of the sort of the church without Christ from the position of the Inquisitor and the Inquisitor who arrests the Christ that raises the dead child, where it seems as though he's saying that this edifice of religion is built on the blood of an innocent, and yet the Inquisitor is an agent of death in a way, at least an agent of contradicting, or at least preventing the good that sort of this Christ in the story brings. But I felt like that was kind of paradoxical.
Does seem to be, yeah. I think it's worth following up on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where's the Russian Orthodox Church in this day and age? I mean, as far as the relationship to the state and its political stance and maybe its theological teachings on suffering and evil. I mean, do you know anything? Is any of that feeding into Yvonne's view? I mean, I know he's criticizing Roman Catholicism, but if he's saying this is how the church should be, how was the church in his day there in Russia?
Well, I mean,
were they just completely disconnected and uninvolved with the state, or was there?
Well, I mean, this is a complex question.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to put it very, very briefly, two things. One, the Russian church, the Orthodox Church in general. I'm almost tempted to say, you know, I'll know more as soon as I check Wikipedia. I'm not terribly versed on all of this, but they were very parish-based, right? In other words, bishops, power was distributed, authority was distributed, and there were not these grand thought edifices that swept across the whole of the believers. They were really tied much more closely to a believing community, to a particular believing community. But this also meant that as a church, they didn't have as much power, so they had to let themselves be dominated by the state a great deal more. So then, yet the state needed them to be accepted by the people. So we have that same problem. It's a problem that doesn't go away, right? But so it's not that the state's need for the church and the church's need for the state doesn't exist, but the closer they become, the more certain fundamental structures of our humanity are endangered. That's kind of a very, very general question. Did you have somebody question over here? Okay.
How much trust can we put in Father Zosima?
There's a good. That's a blunt question.
Kind of,
I like that.
Yeah.
A
well,
lot.
You want to like sort of like hold on to him as you know your starting place, like where to go from. But at the same time, like something about his character might leave you a little bit uneasy.
Yeah. Well, and Dostoevsky does that on purpose, right? Because we have to. He leaves us just as he doesn't give Yvonne really villainous characteristics, you know, and he's not a villain, he's a suffering young man, right? We're asked to inhabit these characters, to be immersed in them. And if you haven't gotten to the long testimony of Zosima yet, you know, I think you get just enormous dimensions of his character in that. So hang in there. It's all good. under the, is that a vague enough formulation for you? Yes, I think it's worth trusting Zosima. But I understand, you know, just exactly what, he's a character. He's a character in a novel that, you know, ambiguous and vague things happen to. And so we want to look at that when we get a chance to.
Well, he's corruptible, right? He's not incorruptible. They expect him to be incorruptible, but
right.
He's corruptible.
Right.
So is that supposed to reflect back on his previous action?
Well, I think, you know, Dostoevsky put this in his novel, so it's something that we're gonna have to deal with.
Okay.
But I mean, we should, by that point, have also looked at the other characters and, you know, made cautious assessments of all of them and move toward. I'm going to be vague about this because I'm not ready to discuss a future event in the novel yet. Okay. Yeah, Patrick.
What are we to make of the early concurrence between Ivan and Zosima on the church and state question?
Yeah. Well, I think largely the things that I've said just the last couple minutes ago, because of the unremovability of those questions about the church and the state, and that. I mean, but didn't it seem that when Father Zosima and Father Paisi, remember Father Paisi says, so be it, right? He's thinking of it in a different context. He's thinking of it at, you know, in the second coming, more or less. And so there's a sense, there can be visions of the same kind of order in parallel worlds, in different worlds, in opposed worlds. You know, and I think that's one of the kind of themes that we see in Dostoevsky's fiction, you know, that the same kind of order can exist as seen by God and as seen by the devil, more or less, the same kind of order.
So
we have the double, the idea of the double. Yeah.
Would you say that that's a contrast between the Hegelian and maybe John's Gospel?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
so.
Know. Like, what are we? What's the double? Is it? Do we pair up Satan, Hegel?
Lock them in a room. No, I would say that no, the double. What I meant about that was that, you know, the frequent appearance of double figures in Dostoevsky's work. It begins with this work called The Double, an early fiction by him. That kind of structure keeps appearing, and it will appear pretty. Strongly in The Brothers, but it may often be, you know, interpretable as seeing the same kind of complex or the same kind of resolution, same kind of structure from the point of view of, you know, of grace and from the point of view of secularization or something like that. That the structure remains there, but there are different, there are radically different interpretations of it. So, anyway. Second temptation, third temptation. Okay. Power, right? And that is, fall down and worship me. And at this point, he goes on. 238, 239, 240, this long discussion that ends the story of the Grand Inquisitor. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is Saint Alexei, is he the one that was burned and that didn't work and so they decapitated him? Is that the Vita Saint Alexei that he's referencing?
Gosh.
Here,
no, I don't know. You want to look that up? That would be. He says we are.
Well, I just wonder because they're burning the.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of a crucifixion, we have a And they actually refer to the life of Saint Alexis, like he talks about how the lives of the saints are being read, and this one particularly is popular.
Well, I don't know for sure that what the reference is to. So, sorry. At any rate, our inquisitor goes on and makes his case, and says, "We don't need you, and tomorrow I'll burn you." Right, and this is the point that Alyosha breaks out and says, "But that's absurd. What's going on?" He hasn't followed the subtle flip that has happened in the poem. He says, "Your poem is in praise of Jesus, not in blame of him. Right? And who will believe you about freedom? Is that the way to understand it? That's not the idea of it in the Orthodox Church. That's Rome. And not even the whole of Rome. It's false. It's the worst of the Catholics, the Inquisitors, the Jesuits." "Not even the Jesuits. We know the Jesuits. They're spoken ill of. But surely they are not what you describe. They are not that at all, not at all. They are simply the Romish army for the earthly sovereignty of the world in the future, with the Pontiff of Rome for emperor. That's all." So, that's their ideal, but there's no sort of mystery or lofty sorrow about it. So this is his characterization of the Inquisitor. It's all, in other words, for Alyosha, simply fallenness, you know, having fallen to the simple lust for power, for filthy earthly gain, for domination, right? That's all they stand for. They don't believe in God, perhaps, and their faith has grown weak, right? But your suffering inquisitor, who is in a different dimension entirely, this is someone, Ivan would like to say, who has struggled with his faith in a strong and active way and has come to a creative synthesis of a new solution, right? And this is, as he says, a mere fantasy. But he then ends the poem with a brilliant stroke. And after the kiss of Christ, of course, what happens is that the Inquisitor says, "Go. Go and come no more." Right? "Go and come no more." Right? So, in other words, on one hand, we're not gonna put you to death again. The Inquisitor may have had second thoughts about that. A second crucifixion of any sort would be, we'd want that to be avoided at all costs. But "go and come no more" means no second coming as well. We've got it all under control, and we don't want anything disturbing our order. So you might see the confrontation of Christ and the Inquisitor as Ivan's conflict between head and heart, right? That he loves the gentle Jesus, his love of the simplest and easiest and most sentimental things to love in his world produces this image of the meek and unspeaking and gentle kiss of Jesus and so forth. But he knows at the same time, although he won't confront it in direct words, knows how impotent this image is. And logic tells him that the world runs in much more ruthless paths. And so the dilemma of his is created as a poem. A poem of a one-sided dialogue, right? So we have to take over society, it seems to say, to protect those human beings who cannot look after themselves because they are weak, and we have to allow them to sin because they're not capable of better, and so we plan their lives out, and at the grave they know only death. Christ is freed, he's not allowed to die. In that sense, we could be reminded of the epigraph of the whole novel, "Unless a grain of wheat fall to earth and die, it shall not bear fruit." Right? And then how do we respond to this? That at the end, finally, Alyosha kisses Ivan. And Ivan says, "That's plagiarism." So, very, very interesting structure. Brother loves brother. Right? Also, it's telling us, so it may give us a double structure, whereas the kiss is real from Alyosha, it's unreal from the imagined Christ. But it also may be is also, I think, is certainly a testimony that Alyosha doesn't know what to say. That he does not, that he is innocent and naive and has not come up with a true formulation as advanced as Ivan's is. Mm-hmm.
The idea that they die and they don't have an afterlife, I mean, as Alyosha kind of reveals later, that sort of exposes Ivan's not sort of atheism, doesn't believe ultimately.
Right.
But also, it seems to me that it was connected with the loss of freedom, it's like along with the loss of immortality. I mean, I don't know, is that just like sort of reading out of it? But from this, is it a consequence of Ivan's view that without freedom, that men are no longer mortal or capable of immortality? I mean, is it just atheism, or is it a commentary on that as well?
Yeah. clearly there is a connection,
right,
between the two, and it's going to take some subtle thinking to different interpretations could be made. At heart it may be one of the simplest refutations of the Rousseau premise about Christianity and the state, that Christianity turns people into slaves. The very possibility of immortality makes one not so easily dominatable by earthly powers, doesn't it? I know that there's a counter argument to that, but I think it's a strong argument. Mm-hmm.
Would that go along with the image of the girl in the coffin? Because the woman, even though she's a Christian and should believe in immortal life, doesn't. It's one thing for a Jewish woman with a girl to ask, for her to be brought to life, but this Christian woman should have believed in immortality and a resurrection for her daughter. Does that go along with it, perhaps?
I don't know. it's hard to attribute too much to any of these figures that doesn't go directly through Ivan's mind first. It's a haunting figure nonetheless, isn't it? Another kind of general answer that I want to give to some of your questions is that Dostoevsky is a novelist and not making discursive statements. And that if your question about Alyosha, about Zosima, and our trust in him, Dostoevsky is a novelist and is seeking to portray the world as it is. With all the ambiguity that attaches to everything we do in the world. So he wrote to a friend that he risked everything in placing the answer to Ivan in the life and teachings of Zosima, and the question of whether that would work. Could it possibly work? He says, I've proposed to make the sixth book, The Russian Monk, the answer to the whole negative side. I tremble for it, he says. Will it be answer enough? So the contrast is set up, and we should not rush to an easy conclusion about it. The different forms of the two greatest set pieces in the novel are very different, right? The Ivan's has the advantage of being being unreal, and so therefore being every element in the story counts for something. Right? It's very, very economic, it's very dramatic. So Seamless is not dramatic, it's told. It's a told recounting of life experiences, and so there's much in it that goes in different directions and so forth. But notice that he allows Alyosha to tell the elder's story. So we have another example of refraction, but instead of saying, I've made up this poem, Alyosha's goal is to be true to what Elder Zosima has preached and has said, attested to in his own life. So look at the preface to this story, the tellings of the story of the life of Zosima. It's uncannily close to the way the gospel writers write. So it's a strong point in the case for Dostoevsky as having advanced the art of fiction in the aesthetic of the New Testament. He's writing, he's learned to write from the Gospels, and this is truly the prosaic art, the art of prose that was pioneered by the New Testament. And there's been some great stylistic studies of the New Testament. One of them, one of the earliest and best by the German critic Erich Auerbach, that saw that so many of the standards of Greek poetics that we bring to any work are not truly applicable. There's a different standard for the writings of the Bible, and that they do have a past, but that they reach an important breakthrough in the New Testament. This is a little essay called Sermo Humilis. Fascinating piece of work. He associates a prose style of the low style of the three styles in classical writing with Christianity as an intentionally adopted style. I think it's the low style. Maybe it's the middle style. I forget. But it's a very interesting proposal. And that was done in the early 50s. Since then, there have been some very fine studies of the style of the New Testament that are not, you know, that are focused on matters of style and of narrative poetics. And that makes a very interesting connection with Dostoevsky in general, but especially with this portion of it, this the story of the life of Zosima. Okay. So we shall continue now. Next class, you're to have another portion of this novel read. And I think I said through the first 9 books. So. Okay. Now quizzes. I have some quizzes for everybody. And 2 quizzes for some. Adam, Therese. Kristen Fisher. Tom Steigenwald. Nico, Jessica, Nathaniel Helm, Jake Clem, okay.
Was it
Frigid Happiness?
Why is
she?
Three of
them
are
heading to
the
stale. Or of the South. Jonathan.
And they're up on the food chain.
Was he one of those, one of the three apps or something?
Chris.
Yeah.
But he's so smart.
Matt,
I think so. I don't know, Nathan.
Jonathan, tell us.
I haven't actually got it.
Marjorie Baskin.
Oh
my gosh, it's so
amazing.
Are you
going to
get late?
Sarah,
where are you going?
Okay, yeah.
We're trying to catch up.
We're working.
Yeah.
The papers
forth, right?
Okay.
No, okay.
Was that the end?
Hmm?
Was that the last one?
Oh, good. Oh, that's good news.
Turn this off. Forgot about that.